International House of Horrors.
Valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors podcast, your sanctuary is spooky for all things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre. I am one of your curators here at the house, Joe Merle.
And I'm the other one. I'm Josh. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Josh. We are back together again.
Yeah, it feels like it was 2 weeks of not talking, but it feels like months.
Years. I know. It feels like it's been forever. And a huge thank you to Michael for coming back, kind of a film house reunion podcast. And I did, I was talking to a friend of mine who listens to the show yesterday, and he had told me, he's like, I really like those two together. And I said, oh, yeah, they used to have a podcast. He's like, it's so funny. He's like, because they never agree on anything. He's like, their opinions are so different. And I said, you should have listened to them when they had their own show. They were always fighting about something.
Yeah, that's the whole point of the show.
yeah, it does. You know, and it worked out well, especially with you guys, because, you know, you're friends, so you don't get too angry about it. But you both felt very differently about a lot of things back in the film house. But yes, thank you, Michael, for coming through and being a guest on the show. While I couldn't be here, I was out of town. I was in Ohio visiting family for the holidays, so it was awesome that he filled in.
Yeah, and I think he had a good time as well, as much as I've heard. Like he enjoyed being on. He hadn't and hasn't done a podcast. I at least had you to do a podcast with. He was like just sitting there doing nothing.
Right. Which is so very cool that he was able to come through. We're going to do things a little bit differently today, kind of how we've done in the past with this style of episode. We're going to skip the Twilight Zone this week, and we're going to get into our 101 horror movies you got to see before you die. We're going to start with number 21 all the way through 30, and we're only skipping the Twilight Zone because these episodes tend to be a little bit longer as it is, just with the subject matter at hand. There's a lot to talk about when you're talking about 10 different movies.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure we give this topic, especially because it is, you know, the 101 to see before you die. Give it enough time. We don't want the show to be running for 2.5 hours long or anything like that.
Exactly, especially because, especially with these movies, these are movies that are not just like movies we can brush off and just talk about quickly in like a minute. These are movies that we want to talk about for real.
Right. Yeah. And kind of figure out, you know, why was it important to horror? Why is it on this list? Why is it on this list? And a lot of these things are, at least everything we've come across, and I imagine it'll continue to be that way, are pretty high rated critically. And even what was the one we always go back to, the vampire from what was it, 70? Yeah. No, it wasn't the '70s. It was the thirties.
Yeah, 31, I think. Yeah.
So there may be a few on here, you know, that we don't particularly even enjoy, but we can still look at them through the lens of what change did this bring with it, or what did this do to perpetuate horror? You know, did it influence horror 50 years later, whatever the case may be?
Yeah. Why is it a movie we still talk about these days?
Right. Exactly. And I don't think we've come across any on the list that I'd never heard of or at least seen on some list before as far as important horror movies to watch.
Yeah, not yet, but I feel like I've looked ahead what's coming, and there's a few ones that I've never heard of before I looked into this book.
Actually, the next time we do it, there's one on the list. Yeah, there's actually two that I've never heard of before, and hopefully I can find them. That's my only concern, is we're going to get through this and we're going to get to one that's just not available, but thanks to the internet, a lot of this stuff you can find, whether it's ordering a weird DVD that went out of print somewhere or it's just streaming on YouTube, whatever the case may be.
For this particular episode, I ordered 3 Blu-rays from the UK because we didn't have those movies here, but I could order them from over there.
Nice. So, yeah. That's the internet doing what it's supposed to do. So let's just get right into it, man. We're going to start with number 21, which is 1955's Diabolique. And it is I don't know if you say it any different in French. I've always just called it Diabolique. I'm sure
I had like 9 years of French in school. I don't speak any anymore, but I think Diabolique sounds good. Yeah,
Diabolique. Yeah, sounds good. And I know you took a lot of the notes as far as the production side of things and all that fun stuff, or you have it in front of you maybe?
Exactly. I have the book and I have the notes because the book is all in German and I can't translate on the fly. So I...
what are you talking about? You can't translate on the fly. You need to be able to translate that as soon as you see it.
Well, I guess I actually kind of would be able to, but it's really, it wouldn't sound good.
No, we wouldn't want you to translate on the fly. So this, go ahead.
Yeah, so for the people involved, it's directed by Henri-Georges Clouzot, who is, by the way, often called French Hitchcock, according to this book.
I can definitely see why.
Yeah, and... it's all French people, so most of these names don't ring any bells, but I guess
it's all French people from 1955 as well.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's a few, I think, you know, French actors who have become pretty global in the past like 10, 20 years. But for the most part, I would like to say, oh, I know all this stuff, but I don't. Yeah. And there's a part of me that, you know, I care, but at the same time, I want to talk about the movie itself.
Yeah, exactly. What's interesting about this one is that the director Clouzot, he got the rights right before Hitchcock could. Like Hitchcock wanted to make this movie, but Clouzot snatched it from him, and he made the movie. So this feels very much like a Hitchcock movie.
100%, 100%, and even so, we watched it last night. Shane and I watched it, and I asked her after it was over, I said, would you even call this a horror movie? And she made a really good point, because in so many ways, this movie felt to me like an old noir movie, you know, especially coming out of that area. You had a lot of great stuff coming out of Europe at the time and even 10 years, you know, 15 years prior. But what she said, and she made a really good point, she's like, and spoiler alert, we're going to spoil all these movies. So if you haven't seen them, you know, because I feel like some of these, especially this one, you have to talk about the ending to really discuss why it's important to horror. And for her, she said, yeah, I would consider it a horror because you didn't know what was going on until the very end. And you didn't know if there was a supernatural element or something that was going on. Was there some sort of undead piece to it? You didn't really know till you get to the close.
And they really made it seem like it was about like some undead element, like there was a ghost story behind there.
Right.
So like
right.
Until the last scene, basically, it was like a ghost movie. And then all of a sudden, maybe not.
Right. Maybe not. And this movie was beautifully shot. Like it was a gorgeous movie from start to finish. And I watched it on the Criterion channel. So it was, you know, the best print that they've pieced back together. So I dig it. But the story in a nutshell, you've got two women who work at this boarding school. One of them is the wife of this Michael character, and the other one is the mistress, and they know about each other. Like they're well aware. And he's like, they paint this guy as the biggest piece of shit you could probably ever really imagine. He is horrible. Yeah. He is a horrible human being.
Full on. And like you said, they know of each other and he still keeps it going and like has them both work together. So like it's, you can see he's a shithole from the very beginning and it doesn't get better. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a piece of shit. I mean, to the point where the movie opens up, the mistress has a black eye and she's like, oh, it was Michael again. So he clearly physically abused them. And then a little bit later, after the dinner scene, which is so uncomfortable, where he's forcing her to swallow the food.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that was brutal. But then they don't show anything, but you assume he rapes her, you know, when they kind of walk into the shadows. So there's mental abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, all this stuff going on at the same time. And these two women concoct this plan that they're going to kill him. And they do it in a really kind of a crazy way. You know, they feed him some sedative and then just put him in the bathtub and let him get waterlogged all night long and just leave him there drowning, which the drowning scene, I was pretty surprised for 55. Like that was pretty intense.
Yeah, intense. It was mostly on screen. Like he had to hold his breath for a long time for that scene.
Oh, like,
It was really, really well done and like really shocking for the time. Like the next movie we're going to talk about, there was no on-screen death at all. And then this one like basically drowns the character.
Yeah, everything was on screen, which was, and you even see him, I mean, he slaps his wife around a couple of times, like whack, 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 smacking her in the face. So like you said, a lot of on-screen stuff going on in this one. And then the rest of the movie after this death, they throw the body in the pool waiting for someone to eventually discover it. They keep trying to perpetuate someone discovering it. You know, they're like, oh, something fell in the pool. Go look for it, hoping he's going to find the body. And they get to a point where they have to, the mistress throws her keys in the water and says, oh, I lost my keys. We got to drain the pool. They drain the pool, no body. And then now it's like, oh, what the hell? Like, what is going on? And so for pretty much the remainder of the movie, we see these two women kind of descend into madness trying to figure out what had happened. And I do like that they set us up as the audience when they're talking to that little kid that they keep putting in the corner for 6 hours. When they're talking to him and they have this conversation, all the adults, the other teachers and things, where they say he felt so much guilt about it, maybe he manifested what had happened in his mind. And so that sets up us up, like, could that be a possibility? Is there the chance that these women feel so much guilt that now they're making things up in their mind, even though the body was gone? So you got to explain that piece of it.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I think we skipped the part that he is where there's actually almost comedy in this movie, where they because I think they drown him in their home further away from the school.
Right.
And then they put him like in a big box and carry him through the through the town, almost getting caught a few times. Where we were like really close on the edge, like that felt very much like the kind of humor Hitchcock would put into his movies,
right?
Where you're like, oh, they might find it out now. It's like that. We know there's a bomb in there, and we're just waiting for it to go off. You know, the typical Hitchcock saying,
right? So, like, what was the what's that one? I didn't like it all that much, but it was still good and it had a lot of comedy. What's the Harry Henry?
What's happened to Henry, something like that.
But yeah, there was a lot of comedy in that as well, like, oh no, it's just about to happen. And in that, yeah, you're right, the drunk soldier, the drunk French soldier walking around, and then the, you know, he lifts up the thing, and even with the neighbors when they had to get the piece of twine to tie it down, let's take some of the stuff out of there, I got some other baskets for you.
Yeah, exactly. It was good. By the way, you talked about, just to jump in there, you talked about the ending, that it's gonna be spoiled. And this is one of those movies similar to Hitchcock, who said for Psycho that no one is allowed to enter the cinema after the movie started. Yeah. The same thing happened with this movie, where the director actually said people are not allowed to go into this, the theater until the movie started.
I wondered if Hitchcock pulled influence from this for Psycho as far as the marketing and that, because even with Diabolique in the credits, it tells you, like, don't tell your friends. Don't be. And I joked with Shayna when we saw that. I was like, holy shit, they were talking about spoiler alerts in 1955. Like, don't tell your friends what the ending is.
Yeah, and also they made it in like this fun way where they write like, don't be diabolique. That's so great. And actually the same ending happens in the next movie we're going to talk about, where there's also a title card at the end, don't tell people what's going on.
Right, right. So let's talk about the ending of this. You know, we have all these events that lead up to the end of Diabolique again, where you have these two women who are essentially going mad. They start to see Michael in different places, you know, in the school photo, you see his face back there. His suit shows up.
It was in the
window of the school photo. His suit shows back up, the one that he had been wearing, they knew he was wearing when he was drowned, like comes from a dry cleaner. There's an apartment under his name. They go there. And then you have a retired police commissioner who acts as a private detective type character trying to help the wife in all of this, trying to help her figure out what happened. And so we have his angle as well, where he'll come back and say, oh, I saw him. Like, I know where he's at. That's where we get right to the end. Oh, and there's a big piece, I guess we forgot, is Michael's wife has a heart condition. She has, throughout the whole movie, that really is an important piece. She has this heart condition. And by the end of it, she's in bed, like almost dead, you know, from her heart stuff. She starts seeing things. She starts hearing typing in Michael's office. She goes in there and she sees a paper that's typed out that has his name typed on, almost like The Shining. Like, it's just typed all over the paper. Yeah. And he is in, she goes into her bathroom and he is in the bathtub. We see him drowned and then he stands up with these horrible, like, white eyes. Almost, yeah. And you believe right up to the end, like, is he, like, what is this? A ghost, a zombie? And it plays really well to where he pulls out the eye, I guess, kind of like covers, almost like thick contact lenses yeah. in a way that would give the appearance of white. That sends her, at least we believe, into shock and she dies. Like she's given into her heart condition. She's dead. Then the mistress comes out and we realize they've been in cahoots the entire time. And it was yeah. good. Like it was a really good reveal. Even, I gotta say, for a movie from 1955, because this is one of the few that I hadn't seen, a movie from 1955, at least I thought I saw it, but I don't remember it. I was still guessing the whole time. Like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What is the payoff here?
Yeah, and I remember, like, I had this idea throughout the whole movie and was, like, expecting to basically... I don't even remember what my idea was, but it was, like, something where I felt like it's probably going to be, like, some standard reveal or something. And then this happened, and I was like, oh, that's yeah. really good.
It was really good. But they don't last long. They, as soon as they concoct their plan, because the whole time, the mistress and the husband, their plan was to sell the school, take the money, and then take off, because yeah, she had inherited the school.
Yeah, I guess what we didn't say yet was that the wife character, she was the rich person, like Michael married her for the money. And then their plan was to kill her in like this very obscure way.
Yeah, to get away with it. Almost the perfect murder. Everyone knows she has a heart condition if they can drive her heart to break. And the ending is left a little ambiguous. We don't 100% know what happened, especially the conversation she had with the detective where he says, get some rest. Don't worry. By the morning, you'll be acquitted. And I was like, wait, what exactly is he saying there? And then the cop takes those two away, says, you know what? You're going to jail for 15 to 20 years. That's it. So they don't get away with the murder at all. But we close out with that same little boy who had said he had seen the principal, who is the husband, who is Michael, now says he has seen the wife. He's like, I saw her. She gave me back my slingshot or whatever it was. And so we don't know if somehow she is still alive. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe like she came now back as a ghost to seek revenge.
Yeah.
Like, it's been like half a year since I saw the movie. Isn't it also like a point where they're like saying maybe he came back because they killed him and like he wants to take revenge?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like part of me thinks maybe she was in on it as well with the cop. And that was something that happened off screen. Like, hey, if you see something, because the cop never left the school. You know, he was there the whole time. Why did he stick around? It's almost as if he knew something was happening, especially the way he said, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years. I've seen it all. I'm really good at my job. I don't know if maybe she was in cahoots with him. Like, hey, you see something. I want you to pretend you have a heart thing so that I can catch these people in the act together.
Oh, that would be like, yeah. See, that's the good thing about this movie, that even now, like 64 years later, we can 65 years later,
yeah.
we can still talk about this movie.
And yeah, like, it's really good.
Have predictions, yeah.
Yeah, it was really good. So I would highly encourage people to give that a watch. And it is available. It might even be on YouTube. I'm not sure. I just watched the Criterion version of it. But I know I've seen many copies of like DVDs and things and Blu-rays over the years. So if you do want to watch it, it's not impossible to find. You can definitely check it out. But yeah, it gets a thumbs up from me. Really good.
Yeah, from me as well. Most of these black and white movies from the 50s are widely available these days. So yeah, this is another one of them. And so I'd say we talked already about it. It is kind of a horror movie. Because most of the time we're wondering, is it a horror movie? Is it a ghost story? And so it's got this feeling. And I think it had enough of an influence on the horror genre in general that we can say this belongs on the list of the 101 horror movies to see.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. And especially after what Shane had said, she's the one that completely convinced me when she said, you didn't know until the very end that it was horror or it wasn't. And I was like, that's true. That's very true. Like, and I like that. You know, I like the idea of it. And the same, you could say the same thing almost about Saw. You know, you don't really know until the very end, even though that's more of a torture movie. But I think the biggest thing here is that horror realizes it has an educated audience. It wasn't just kids at matinees, you know, a twofer, Dracula and Frankenstein, where horror could be a little more intellectual and keep you guessing and thinking throughout the whole thing. And people would take that and they'd appreciate that and they'd like that. And Diabolique did a lot.
Yeah.
Good movie.
For sure.
All right, you ready to move on?
Yeah, let's move on to the next movie from 1956. It's called Bad Seed by director Mervyn LeRoy, who also wrote it, produced it. Like, he was all in this movie. And the actors, there are some that we know, especially Patty McCormick, Nancy Kelly. Right. And I think even Eileen Heckert, who all were nominated for an Oscar for this movie. So this is one of those.
Yeah, they should have been.
Yeah.
And this was based on a play, right?
Yeah, it was not only based on the play, but most, if not all, of the actors were actually in the play, in the Broadway production.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so especially thinking about Patty McCormick, she had this role. She started this role when she was 8 years old on the Broadway. And then when she was 10, they made the movie out of it. So they had to make her a bit younger. But still, it was like, she was doing this role for 2 years, and I think that really helped her because she
absolutely she was so good.
I'm so still good. Scared of her,
right? Like, and it's a movie that I've loved for a long time, and for many reasons. I think the play aspect you can really see in there because a lot of it is same locations.
Yeah, it's all, you know, in the house.
For the most part,
the house.
Yeah, when they went to the park.
Oh yeah, for the one time where they visit the yeah, right.
Yeah, they go to the park, and I think that was one of the only scenes where we left the house.
Well, the ending as well. But
right.
Yeah.
So
I've seen this movie for the first time yesterday.
Yeah, I want to hear what you think about it.
Yeah.
I just want to hear all your thoughts. Go ahead.
So very similar to the last movie, this is also one where we can say, is this really a horror movie? I'd say it is, and it perfectly works for this list, but it's, yeah, I love this movie so much. Like, I'm glad I got the Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah, because it's one you can go back to many times, and I think with the, more than even, is this a horror movie or is this not a horror movie, I think what this did for a horror is show you that kids can be evil.
Yeah.
Which we hadn't seen a lot leading up to this point. You know, and this really painted a picture of kids can be monsters as well. And that leads into, I mean, you talk about the influence in even modern horror stuff, like The Good Son, or any of those, Village of the Damned, Children of the Corn. There's so many you could name off, and I believe they all owe some sort of credit to Bad Seed and the fact that it showed us a world where kids can be monsters, and man, this girl is a fucking nightmare. She is scary, scary, scary.
Yeah, and so for anyone who doesn't know this movie, so one question before I start getting into this, like, when is it a spoiler? Because this is one of the movies that also, like, I posted the title card of this movie to Instagram yesterday, because at the ending card of the don't spoil this movie yesterday, and so I'm really wondering what exactly is the part that's to be spoiled here. Like, I didn't know much about the movie to go in, but I knew it was about a girl who might be evil. I think the official description on IMDb is like a mother suspects her little kid to be a serial killer. And that is kind of the plot, but I don't think it's even a spoiler to say that we find out pretty early on that she is a serial killer, like that she killed people before. So is the spoiler warning for this just the last shot? Because I think that's like one of the worst parts of the movie, really.
Yeah, I don't know, because you do learn very early on that this girl is crazy. Yeah. And I don't even know if I'd call her a serial killer, because she's more of like a sociopath. She has no measure of right and wrong. She doesn't feel anything right or wrong.
Yeah, that's
everything
true.
To her, like, hey, if you don't get me what I want, then I'm justified in killing you. Whereas I feel more serial killers do it for some sort of pleasure along the way, or some sort of internal tick, something that makes them do it. Whereas for her, she's more of a sociopath because she's so like bright and chipper and happy all the time, but then something doesn't go her way and she's a nightmare.
Yeah, and I love her performance like all throughout. Like even when she is like, it feels kind of odd the way she behaves all the way throughout because
yeah.
she's always this exaggerated nice, you know. The opening of the movie is like this, and it kind of worked on a different level because she is playing a role that we would see in movies at those times. Like if right. there was a kid in the 50s in some sort of movie,
like it Leave It to be. Beaver. Yeah, it's a very Beaver Cleaver.
Yeah, she's just perfect, the nicest little girl. And like I bet there was a movie coming out this year, the same year, 1956, where there was a little girl who behaved exactly like that, but she was just the nice little girl of the movie.
Right, right.
And so I think it worked even more, even if it was a bit over the top. Like it also makes sense because, of course, a little girl would go, that doesn't really know how to behave, goes over the top to be the most perfect girl ever. That's what we see in all these sociopath movies, right?
Right.
And yeah, so she is so perfect. Then when she gets angry, I just love
she flips her. A switch. Yeah.
Yeah.
She really, I mean, Patty McCormick did such an amazing job. And like yeah. you said, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if you saw Fences with Denzel and Viola
Not
Davis.
Yet, no.
Such a good movie. But I think part of it is so good because those two had been doing it on the stage together for like 156 shows or something. They knew the material so well. So for Patty McCormick, it wasn't come into this and learn the material. She yeah. knew the material. And it shows. And I think that because many times, especially in horror, if you have a kid that can't act, that's it. Movie's over. You know, it takes you out of it. For instance, I was watching... What was I watching yesterday? Friday the 13th, or no, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, the Dream Child. And some of the stuff with the kid, and then after that I watched New Nightmare. And even some of the stuff with that kid, if they can't act well, it pulls you out almost immediately.
Yeah.
And you're just done with it. So this movie, to talk about the plot a little bit, is us as the audience trying to figure out if this girl is truly evil, but you learn... relatively early.
It's like halfway through, like when she actually just confessed, like you basically know she did it when she comes home after.
So with the medal.
Yeah.
When her mom finds the medal that she took off the little boy.
I feel like I was even sure that she did it when she just came home all chipper and happy after the boy just got drowned. And they don't really make it a mystery where you're wondering, Did she do it or not? No, she comes home and says, "Well, yeah, he's dead, but that's okay."
Can I have my peanut butter sandwich now?
Yeah,
yeah.
And so we know, and that was the boy she was talking about before. That like he doesn't deserve this medal. That was the first time we saw her get evil, really.
Yeah.
And so for me, maybe it was also because I'm now at a point in time where we know kind of how these movies work, and maybe at the time it was different, but I felt like I was sure she is the killer. Like that's yeah. what this movie probably is going to be about. A little part of me was expecting that it like in the Jello movies, that maybe we will have this switch at the very end where someone completely different who is the killer and they just made us all go crazy. But yeah, it wasn't the case. And then, like, I think after just 1 hour, like halfway through, the girl actually confesses to her mother that she did it.
Right.
And then also goes on to confess that she killed the old lady before.
Right. Pushed her down the stairs for a snow globe yeah. with a fish in it.
Yeah.
And she just, and those are the scenes to me that were the most uncomfortable, where this girl, even after confessing to these murders, is still talking to her mom like, "Oh, I have the best mother. You're the most wonderful mother." She's continuing to try and manipulate the world around yeah. her, even after confessing to murders. And then we get the other half, or the other side of the coin, I should say. You now have a mom who's trying to deal with this confession of a child. And do I give up my child? How do I protect her? What do I do in this situation? And it's tough.
Yeah, and also about, like, she is at the same point finding out that she is adopted and that her mother is a serial killer.
Yeah.
And also there's this whole talk that I thought was really like something I wouldn't expect from a movie from 56. This whole talking about like, can you be evil just from inheritance or genetics. Is it something of your environment? Yeah, and her dad is really saying that it can't be, it's all environment, because of course he got the daughter of a serial killer and grew her up, and she became a nice woman, but then the daughter of her, not so much.
Yeah, almost like this recessed gene that was in the daughter.
Yeah.
And so for the, and I like Leroy a lot. He was a fun character because he would just, you know, and Leroy is kind of their, he oversees the grounds of the apartment building in which they all live.
Yeah.
And so the mom does help her destroy some evidence, the shoes. And that's now the mom's completely in cahoots with the kid. The girl ends up killing Leroy down in the basement by lighting a pile of hay or something he's on fire, which I'm like, man, that was pretty fucked up even for the time. Because he's screaming, like beating on the door, like, let me out, let me out.
Yeah,
I'm burning alive down here.
While the little girl is playing the Au Clair de la Lune that she's playing all throughout the movie. And that's even like in the score. That's something I want to add really quick is that like the movie starts off with her playing Au Clair de la Lune. And then later on in darker scenes, there's like a darker version of that same song.
Yeah,
that I thought was really good. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we get to the end of this movie where, at, you know, outside of the very end of this movie, I think the ending is great.
The ending is perfect if it wasn't for that last scene.
Yeah, because it's haunting. The ending of this movie is haunting, where the mother now well, you know what? Maybe we don't spoil this one.
Okay,
I feel like that ending is so good.
Yeah, let's
it
not
really
spoil
does because the movie almost opens up kind of goofy and very 1950s, like you said, cookie cutter, kind of happy world family. And then by the time you get to the end, they've taken you on this great emotional journey. So we'll leave that ending alone. We won't do that one because that is one where even as many times as I've seen it, every time I watch it, I'm like, fuck, that's good. Like that was just so well done.
And it just works so perfectly.
Yeah.
Also, what I also wanted to add about the ending, but I can also say it about other parts of the movie, is that it's perfectly written, I feel like. There's always something setting up other things where it doesn't feel forced at all. Like in the very opening, the old neighbor, what's her name again? I can't
like
remember.
Like Maureen or so. It was some with an M.
Yeah.
Aunt Monica.
She comes down and she has like this gift for the little girl. She has this bracelet, and she gives it to her, and we also see it as showing her character that she wants not only the one bracelet, she wants both parts of the bracelet.
Yeah.
So and Monica says, okay, I'll get you both. That's no problem. And but she keeps the bracelet for now. And then a bit later on, the mother goes on to Aunt Monica comes back to get the bracelet to get the second one. And and the mother goes to the jewel case to get to the treasure chest to get this.
Yeah.
And then she finds the medal.
So right.
it made total sense that she would go there and find the medal there. It was perfectly set up. And that we see all throughout this movie where there's like things happening early on that set up later events and still make sense. You don't think there's something weird about that scene in particular. When often like movies get that wrong and just like find some excuse to get you somewhere where this, it all makes sense.
Yeah. This, and man, that ending is so good. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on to our next one, we've got 1957's The Curse of Frankenstein. Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah. Now we're getting to Hammer horror. And before we get into this movie, I want to add something because, what the book says on this page is, that if we don't count the Atomic Age monster movies of the 50s, there have basically been no more horror movies since the 1947, since 1947 until we got this one.
Yeah.
And so I looked back into the book and yeah, we ended last week, last time we did this, we ended on I Walked with a Zombie from 1943. And since then, the whole book, at least, well, it's only the book of the 101 movies, but still, The book went then on to 1955 and 56 with two movies where we're even not sure if it's really a horror movie.
And like, yeah, that's true.
In those 10 years, like in, I think in 47, it ended with like the Universal Monster Mesh movies where it almost became comedy. And since then, there have been no real horror movies until we got, and that's not only in the US, but actually all over the world. Because like, the, all over the world.
That's interesting. And I wonder if some of that had to do with the real horrors of World War II and people just done, you know what I mean? Like, I've been through so much, they probably didn't want to go to the theater. So, and this is, I'm speculating. I have no idea if that's true, but you know, World War II had just ended when, well, a year after I Walked with a Zombie came out, and people were probably like, there's been enough horror in the world. Give me some, give me something else besides, you know, monsters and things like that. Or maybe there was a lot of war movies coming out at that time. I don't know.
Yeah, and then of course we were in the times where people started to get the after-war time, and then we got to the atomic age of the 50s where it wasn't like we had monster movies, like we had
giant
Godzilla.
Spiders and them, Earth versus the Spider,
which were all more sci-fi than real horror.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
true.
There were these kind of horror movies that they are discounting here and saying, other than the atomic age monster movies.
Right, because you think about all the like space movies and things like that, you know, aliens and Martians. And yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so I thought that was really interesting. And yeah, then in 1957, we start the new era of horror, like we started it like 30 years prior with, well, this time we start with Frankenstein and then follow with Dracula and start the other way
around.
And
how good is the poster for The Curse of Frankenstein? Ah, it's so, so fantastic. At least the one that shows up on my iTunes when I open it up.
Yeah.
And this, you had kind of mentioned it really quickly, but this is the start of the Hammer era of horror. And so we had, and I don't even know who started the Hammer stuff. I don't even know a lot of the names attached to it. Who were like the founders of the production company? Because well, I think it was more than just... Yeah, go ahead.
I got the all the people here. So like a production is Anthony Hinz and Max Rosenberg, who I guess were the producers of Hammer Horror. And of course, this brought all the big guys together that were like the main people of this... of this romance. And this was the first Hammer Horror movie.
Nice. So, and what a good way to kick it off.
Yeah. Directed by Terence Fisher, starring Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, Hazel Court, I think was also in a few of those. And yeah, music by James Bernard. James Bernard, I think. So it's all already like this cast we see all throughout the future movies.
Right. And what a great cast they are. Like, they really do such an amazing job. And so what I always liked about Hammer and the Hammer horror movies is that they took established stories and made them scarier. They, you know, like Frankenstein, all the kind of the pre-war stuff, the post-World War I, the pre-World War II stuff, it was amazing. But at the same time, it was very clear, cut and dry, good guy, bad guy. Like you had really fine lines, and there's always been, I don't know what that quote you always say is about, you know, intelligence is knowing that Dr. Frankenstein was the monster. Yeah. And we don't get that until this movie. And, you know, Peter Cushing does such an amazing job as Victor Frankenstein. He's fucking awful. Like he really is a horrible human being.
Yeah. Like completely. Like also, like he has this he has his like cousin I think that he plans to marry, but also like is having an affair with his housemaid and telling her he's gonna leave the cousin for her,
right?
Like all like that's like in a 50s movie. Like this is not something we usually see in these kind of movies.
Yeah.
And also what the book also says a lot about Hammer horror in general is what they did is they brought blood, color, and gore to the genre,
the monster genre, kind of the universal stories for the most part.
Actually, to horror in general, like even like the last few movies we saw, there wasn't really that much gore. I think there was like when was Herschel Gordon Lewis starting?
He was in the 60s.
In the 60s. So that was after this. So this was really the start of like getting gore in horror movies. And also, they also brought sex to the genre again, like with lots of cleavage and.
And he even, you know, him with his mistress, which I thought made him even more just diabolical, was she's like, I'm pregnant. And he's like, well, got to get rid of you. Like, there's I can't do anything about that. I got to marry my cousin because that's the right thing to do. But the story is essentially the same. They don't change much about the core story, so we don't have to get into a lot of details because it is a mad doctor who creates a monster, has becomes fixated on this kind of dark science and bringing the dead back to life. I do like we spend more time seeing how he gets all the body parts and things like that. Like how he's, you know, kind of backdoor at the morgue. Like, hey, I need some hands and I need some arms. Help me out here. Because he inherits a ton of money at the beginning. And even as a kid, he brings on this scientist to teach him. I want to learn everything I can. And they become partners in all of this. You know, Victor Frankenstein has enough money to continue to fund the research. But it does reach that moral point where the partner says, you know what, this isn't right, what we're doing anymore. Like, we got to stop what we're doing. And then Victor's always locked away in his lab doing his thing. And how good did Christopher Lee look as the monster?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he was really just gross and disgusting.
It looked more of what this kind of monster would be like, because, like skin almost falling off. Like, each part was put there individually, so it makes sense that he's... And yeah, he's also a giant because that's just Christopher Lee. Like, he was really tall.
Yeah, he was like 6'5" or something like that. He was a really big guy.
Yeah, and he's just so great. He's in this movie not very much. Like, he's in way too little.
No, the last maybe like 15 minutes, you really get a good look at him.
Yeah.
That's about it.
But yeah, he is great in this. But yeah, Peter Cushing really fully steals the show.
Oh, and yeah, he shines.
Where he turns from bad mad scientist to just plain out evil is when he has almost everything done, and he usually got the body parts from like the black market or like from morgues. But yeah, then he actually like invites this like the smartest man there is to his home. And it's I just love that whole scene where he's like they go up the stairs, look at a painting, and then he says, "Doctor, look out!" and pushes
right.
I'd say is maybe not the best thing to kill someone to get their brain because
you're gonna cause like hemorrhaging and stuff in the brain.
Yeah, but and that was just so plain out evil. Before that, he just talks to him very nice and says how much he appreciates him, and then he just plain out kills him like. And I love that he even like tries to set up like there's something happened. I tried to warn him, but he just says it probably so that the other people hear it that way. They says, "Doctor, look out!" And then he falls
down the stairs.
Yeah, but then we even get the same thing that happens in I guess all the Frankenstein movies where he wanted to get that brain, but then he is stopped at the last minute by his colleague. And so the brain is destroyed and he has to get another one. And it's, of course, the brain. Is it a bad brain in this one as well? Like where it's
I don't remember if they explicitly say it's bad. I always think of Young Frankenstein where when he's like, "I got you a brain." He's like, "Yeah, it's from Abby Normal." And he put the abnormal brain in Peter Boyle. But yeah, something always happens in these movies where they end up with a different brain. But it always, and in this one, you do, again, feel a lot of sympathy for the monster.
Yeah, even though less than in the old one.
Right.
But
you don't see as much of the emotion as you do, especially in, say, Bride of Frankenstein. But in this one, you do get some sympathy for the monster. But for me, this always was the best, or one of the best, because they show you how evil Victor Frankenstein is.
Yeah. Also, by the way, the book says about this movie, well, it says that critics says that this is like the end of Western civilization is what critics said when it came out, because it was just so, you know, they were used to black and white movies where there was like a happy end and there's always like there is good and bad, and in general, there's not as much blood and gore like in this one.
Right.
And so they hated it. And like, there's one critic, his name is C.A. Lejeune, for The Observer. He says that this is one of the six most disgusting movies that I ever had to see.
Wow.
And yeah, that's like, well, he probably didn't see any of the most recent movies because it got much worse. But yeah, this is...
He probably quit his job once Herschel Gordon Lewis started doing his stuff. He's just like, yeah. I'm done. I'm fucking done.
Probably, yeah. And yeah, also about the makeup, I'm guessing you know that, but for all the listeners as well, like why does the monster look like it does in the movie? Well, because Universal still had patented the makeup of Jack Pierce, so they had to do something else. And I'd say they did a pretty good job. Like, it's not.
Yeah, I like the makeup. I like it.
And this movie is not really about the... Well, it's about the real monster. It's about Frankenstein and not the monster itself.
Right. Yeah, and I would agree.
So, yeah, the monster only shows up for like 10 minutes, and it's all about how much of a monster the real Frankenstein is.
Yes. It's a great movie. And all these, I mean, there's not one on here that I wouldn't say, you know, don't watch it, because they're all good. And so moving on to our next one. What do we got, Josh?
Well, for the next one, we got... It depends where in the world you are. If you are anywhere other than the US, it's just called Dracula. If you go to the US, it's called Horror of Dracula. Because, to not confuse you Americans.
Well, but, I don't know if they could... Yeah, I don't know if they could. I don't even know if they could. Could they just call it Dracula?
They could. I think that's like property that they could name. That's just the name. But... actually, what the book says is that there was too much confusion, especially because like movie theaters ordered the wrong prince and ordered the old Dracula.
Okay. Yeah.
And so to change that, they did. Because imagine going to the theater in 1958 to see the new Dracula with Christopher Lee, and then you see Bela Lugosi on screen. Because the theater ordered the wrong prince, so that's why they
they
changed the title.
That makes sense.
Yeah, this one is also... This was a year after Curse of Frankenstein. It's still Terence Fisher, still James Bernard, still Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and yeah, lots of others. And yeah, it's this time based on Dracula. And yeah.
It is... I mean, outside of Lugosi, Christopher Lee is probably the most iconic Dracula.
Yeah.
And I would say, unlike Lugosi, even though I love Lugosi so much, like, I mean, that is my Dracula for the most part. Christopher Lee is scary. Like, he is a menacing vampire. And, you know, he's got, and again, just like Frankenstein, not much has changed with the story. The story is essentially the same.
Even less than in Frankenstein. Here, it's the same.
You've got the Brides of Dracula, who I thought are really good. Like you said, though, they really push like the cleavage and the sexuality of the Brides of Dracula. But the story is almost the same. They just up the gore, up the blood, and you know, we see the bite marks with blood leaking out of them in the neck and things like that. But Christopher Lee is such, and it's so fun that you get a complete flip-flop of the characters, where in this one, Peter Cushing, playing Van Helsing, is such a nice, lovable character, and now Christopher Lee is truly the evil presence in this movie. And I don't know what all to say about this movie, because I feel like it is, I mean, the story's the same. They didn't really change anything at all, but it's just scarier. They showed that Dracula could be a scary figure in the world of monsters.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you said, it's more graphic. That's what the book says as well. The book also says, like, of course, we can add that this is like the first movie of a series that went on to the 70s. Like, they made Dracula movies all throughout like a whole decade and then some. It's one of the movies that influenced horror movies probably the most, while Curse of Frankenstein was a movie that is really good, and but Dracula is the one that really changed history. Like, that's the movie people talk about. People don't talk as much about Curse of Frankenstein, I'd say, but they really talk about Dracula.
They know Dracula, yeah.
Yeah.
Or the horror of Dracula.
And after Frankenstein like started the Hammer horror movies, this one really boosted it and strengthened the Hammer horror name and made them like the household name that they were at the time. Like this was the movie that changed it for them as well.
And for me, it was awesome to see a cool Batman connection in this movie, which I don't know if you're familiar with the Batman stuff, but Michael Gow, who is in this one, played Alfred Pennyworth in all of both the Burton ones and both of the Schumacher Batman movies.
Which
it was cool to see him as a much younger man. Yeah. You know, he played Holmwood, so he was Arthur in Dracula.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So as a much older man, he played Alfred Pennyworth.
Yeah, that's always with the Alfreds. They always played something like way back.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So we can move on from Dracula, you know, because it's one that, again, there's not much to say outside of it's really good. And like you said, it kind of ushered in a new era of the Dracula character.
Yeah, exactly. And one more thing, the last thing the book says about it is that the movie really like led horror movies into the 60s where things started to change.
I would agree.
Yeah, but before we get into the 60s,
we got one more from the 50s. One that I told you, you know, you had been telling me for a long time, months and months and months, you got to watch this movie. And we did talk about it pretty extensively, so we don't have to get into too many of the details. You want to hear us talk about the William Castle stuff, you can go back and listen to that episode. But it is 1959's The Tingler. And it is still so much fucking fun. This movie is just the same way that I think Curse Frankenstein and Dracula brought in, you know, gore to horror. This really showed you can have a fun time with horror. It was more horror comedy, I would say, than anything else.
Yeah, it really was. But it still worked, like especially like if you went to the cinema where this movie was screened in Percepto.
Right.
which means that at some point during the movie, like your seat would start to vibrate because, yeah, this movie is about a monster, the Tingler, that grows in your spine if you're scared. And if you don't scream, then it's going to kill you.
That's the biggest thing. You got to scream in order to get rid of it. And I love, you know, we talked about John Waters saying when he was a kid, he would try and find the seat that he knew had the Tingler sensation in it. But and even outside of that, I love the actual Tingler when we get to see it. When it's outside of the body, it looks so good.
It looks really good. And it looks like a spine. Like it would sit on your spine perfectly.
Almost like a centipede in a way, like all these little legs moving it across the ground. And of course, you got the great Vincent Price,
who you
could never go wrong with. Never go wrong with Vincent Price. So we did talk about this a ton, and we're already almost at an hour. So I don't think we'll spend a ton of time because that was only. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add two things that the book says. For once, it says it predates the 70s movies where the body fights his owner.
It's
kind of
like
that kind of like it put that out there way early in 59. And also it's very modern in its depiction of human relationships that are sometimes without compassion and understanding.
Especially with that, the guy and his wife.
Yeah,
that was bad.
Yeah, exactly. That's what the book says, and that's something we also didn't see as much in the 50s. Like that's also something in Bad Seed. Like it is a perfect relationship between the husband and the wife. Like all throughout.
Yeah, so, that's true.
And this one actually made like human relationships a bit of something else. But yeah, we can go on because we're already at an hour. And
right, we still have five movies to go. So the next one up, 1960s Eyes Without a Face. And holy fuck, if you want to talk about old movies that still work, this is one of them, man. This is one of them. And after I had finished watching Eyes Without a Face, and before you get into some of the production stuff, in so many ways, and I don't even know if I should make this comparison, but in a lot of ways, as far as the remote setting, the kind of weird surgical transformations, it almost reminded me of Human Centipede, like the first Human Centipede movie, in that you have a doctor doing really fucking weird things, medical things, but now in this case, it's his daughter that he's trying to save, but he has no compassion or care for human life along the way, in order, and as long as he can meet his end. And you're at this real old estate the entire time, this kind of old manor where we had with the human centipede as well.
Yeah, that is true. Now that you say it, maybe it was inspired by that a little bit.
Yeah, even though I always heard Tom Six say, he was like, what's the worst thing that could ever happen to a pedophile? And that's where he came up with the idea for a human centipede. whereas with this, though, and some of the imagery in this movie is still just, it's nightmare fuel, man.
Yeah,
it really is nightmare
even
fuel.
Just the typical, even just the typical posters of this movie are... are really good. Like, it's just, sorry, my audio just played a little clip from my last recording that I still had on my ears. So I just lost all thread because I had forgotten to delete like one little part. So Michael talked into my ear.
Michael's haunting the podcast. Yeah, it's a good podcast to haunt, Michael.
I got to remember to cut that part out later or it's going to be really confusing. even just the poster, like this mask of the girl looks, because it's all without any features, it looks really scary and kind of takes you out of it. But yeah, actually my book says, by the way, it's from 1959, but that's like a point of like when it got released where, because this is a French-Italian movie.
Right.
So it's directed by Georges Franjou. And once again, lots of French names that... I always think the director for these kind of movies is worth talking about, but for the actors, it says here Pierre Prasseur, Alida Valli, Edith Scob, but I don't know who was who, so it's really like...
And it's weird also, you know, we live in this age now where I remember even being like a teenager, like 13, 14 years old, you had to remember all that stuff because you didn't have, you know... immediate access in your pocket to look it up if you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have your phone that's essentially a computer in your pocket where you could just look up anything you wanted. Like, hey, I want to find out about Eyes Without a Face. There's a whole Wikipedia page dedicated to this movie.
Yeah.
And all of these actors. You can click on one of their names, it'll bring up everything they ever did.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
So we're kind of fortunate in that respect.
Yeah, for sure. And what the book says about this movie, what I thought was really interesting, was this is a contemporary of the next few movies, Psycho and Peeping Tom. It was condemned by everyone. Like, no one liked this movie when it came out. They all said, it's horrible. The only one who kind of got over that was Hitchcock with Psycho. But Eyes Without a Face is another one. I think we've both seen this for the first time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, so, I had seen, I feel like I had watched it a long time ago, but I didn't remember all the little specifics and the nuance of it and what made it such a great movie.
Yeah, I think it's one that just came back recently again, where people actually started talking about it because, it's not one that people usually go to when they talk about these kind of movies. And it is a great one. Like, it's so scary. And there's some scenes that are like, when there's the operations.
I
guess it was done with like blood squirting out of the little knife, but it looks so good.
When he's cutting the face off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is really, you know, and I don't want to attribute too much to say without this, we wouldn't have that. But you think of like the David Cronenbergs of the world, like the body horror people, or even the Herschel Gordon Lewis's of the world.
Yeah.
Who saw that you could use gore, maybe not Herschel Gordon Lewis because his was always real over the top and like bright red blood and things like that. Yeah. But you could do this body stuff and have these close-ups. You know, it pushed special effects even further. Like, we can accomplish more, make it look real. Because you're right, when that knife's cutting her face off, for all intents and purposes, it looks like a knife cutting a face off.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, the story is about like this... doctor in his remote mansion who has a daughter that lost her face in some accident.
Yeah.
And so he goes around looking for girls that look kind of similar to his daughter to then cut off their face and put it on his daughter. I think something that works nowadays, but at the time was not really done at all. Mm-hmm. Like this is basically science fiction in that regard.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something that really worked at the time.
And his struggles with trying to, you know, okay, we got the face on, but is it going to take? Is it going to hold?
Yeah.
And the mask that she wears when she doesn't have her faces on is so creepy.
It's really scary. Yeah. And then I liked it also, like at one point the face was on. We saw her, just her normal face. And then after a few days, it just kind of fell off again.
It starts to deteriorate and rot, like the skin won't graft on correctly.
Can you imagine having a face that then starts rotting on your head? Yeah. Like that sounds horrible.
Yeah.
And the book also says that, like, this is the one where I wrote the most down, I think, out of the book. Where here the book says that the director was able to mix high art and lower art together. So, like, we have kind of the plot of a B-movie, basically, of a trash movie, where it's, like, about this doctor going around killing people and cutting their faces off.
Yeah. Like that, I mean, it's very Frankenstein.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, and then, on the other hand, it's shot very well and has, like, some deeper meanings. And the book makes lots of ways to compare this movie to Fritz Lang's The Testament of Dr. Mabuse.
Oh, yeah.
Which I have seen once, but I don't remember too much about it. But the book makes lots of comparisons to that movie and even says that it has in common that both movies are about National Socialism and about the Nazis. They're like, these
fucking
are
fucking Nazis.
Yeah. So, like, in this, like, in Dr. Mabuse, it's set before World War II, and it's kind of, Lang is warning about the things that can happen in World War II, while with Eyes Without a Face, Frenu, the director, used the knowledge of the concentration camps to condemn his main character, the socially accepted bad guy. And it's also, of course, a metaphor for all the crazy shit that happened in the concentration camps and the human experiments they did, because that's what he's doing.
Right.
Like he's highly regarded, but he's going around experimenting on girls to save his daughter. And the book also compares the character to the likes of Dr. Moreau of the Island of Lost Souls, and of Dr. Miracle. The murder in of the murder in the Rue Morgue, which is another movie that I haven't seen.
Oh, that's a good movie. I mean, that's a good story. That's just one of my favorite stories. And like, read the book before you watch the movie.
Okay.
Murder in the Rue Morgue is really good. And now that you're saying that, I could definitely see a lot of that stuff in this movie, and especially with the experimentation side of it, because again, he has no regard for human life. Like, it doesn't matter outside of what he's trying to accomplish.
Yeah, exactly.
That's his whole thing.
And it also says that the movie is a radical analysis of the Western belief that there is one class that is higher than another one. So, like, he is a socially regarded doctor, so he can go around snatching people. I think it's always girls, like, out of the asylum that he works on, kind of. Because
yeah,
that,
was
that's
that
what
or the he had his helper, the woman he had lived with, who he had done this for before. He had done some sort of surgery on her.
Yeah.
And so she was kind of in cahoots with him, and they had put the ads out like, hey, I know a room where you could stay. They preyed on people who were looking for help.
Yeah, exactly. And what I found, I'm not sure if this is really, if that's what he really thought of when he shot that scene. But he might, so I'm not sure, but I liked the comparison that they wrote in the book, is that there's one scene where the assistant drives another victim to, I think, to their place to work on her, and she drives next to a train, and that train follows her, like, the whole shot, like, she's always right next to a train, which they compared to, like, the trains that drove to concentration camps.
Oh, so like, okay, yeah.
That's how this movie, like, really combined, like, this B story plot with, like, better movies with, like, higher art. So,
right.
That's what I
Yeah, there's I when I watched this, I never took the time to think of the deeper meaning. Just like, this is a fucking crazy story. Like, this is, but I would say, as far as the cinematography in that, it is beautifully shot.
Yeah.
And so well put together. So well put together. It's a great movie. It is on the Criterion channel. I know there's a lot of versions of it out there. You can, at least I know there's a Criterion DVD that you could buy or maybe even rent if you got a bigger video store or somewhere nearby. And who knows, maybe it's on YouTube. Like I said, a lot of this old shit you can find on YouTube.
Yeah, I remember this one was on YouTube for a long while, and it might be back on YouTube by now. But when I was trying to watch it, it wasn't. So this is one of the Blu-rays that I ordered from Great Britain, because there's not a German release of the movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so you had this one, and you ordered this one, Bad Seed. What was the third one?
The third one was Curse of Frankenstein.
Oh, nice. Okay, yeah. Right on.
So,
all right. Yeah, so moving on, let's get to some shit that ruined a career. It's it really did. As far as my understanding, Michael Powell didn't do a ton after doing 1960s Peeping Tom.
Yeah,
and Peeping Tom, where I think it went bad, was that the audience wasn't ready for this. They weren't ready. They, you know, if you had introduced maybe Psycho first, I think you would have gotten a better reception to Peeping Tom. But Peeping Tom, man, and I don't know, was Peeping Tom first?
According to this book and to what I heard, I think so, yes. Like,
yeah, that
but
makes
only
sense.
Like this
by
is
months,
one of these,
right?
Yeah,
yeah,
this
it was
is
only
one of
months.
These cases where it's like two movies that are very similar in so many regards came out closely at the same time. Like, I think, what was that, when we had Independence Day and Armageddon, like, coming out
right.
in the same year.
Yeah.
And like, it every now and then it happens. And I guess it's always, like, because in the world something similar was going on. So, like, two people got similar ideas. Because these are both movies that are basically seen as, like, the proto-slasher, like, starting
right.
the slasher genre.
And to be fair, with Psycho, you had the name Alfred Hitchcock on it, which that was a name alone that meant something in the world. Whereas Michael Powell, that name didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And nothing to say, like, to take away from the guy, because I really like Peeping Tom, but Hitchcock, you put that name on anything, and it's almost guaranteed to get some sort of a, at least people are going to watch it.
Yeah,
they're
people
gonna
are
going
to watch it, talk about it.
Right, and they're going to appreciate it for, you know, just the Hitchcock name, whereas with Michael Powell, I think people probably left the theater and thought, this guy's a pervert. and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They really could have, whereas Hitchcock was kind of an asshole on the back end of it, you know, fucking all the people. Hetty, what was her name? Who was in Birds? Tippin?
Tippi Hedren.
Tippi Hedren. Yeah, I was thinking of Hedy Lamarr for some reason.
Yeah, no,
Tippi Hedren
was way earlier.
Yeah, no, yeah. He did. Well, yeah, because she had done The Birds with him and Marnie. And I feel like there was one other one they did together. But anyway, back to Peeping Tom. I think the problem people had with this movie is it's very raw. Like, it's, you know, it's like street level. Almost you could. So it deals with a voyeur, serial killer. But you almost feel like a voyeur in your seat. Like, it makes you feel dirty. Like, you're almost doing the same things the way it was shot and the way it was put together.
Yeah. Also, because you are watching a movie about a guy going around shooting a movie of how he kills people and then watching that movie as well. So you're like kind of watching what he's watching. And so
it almost makes you an active participant
in
what's going on.
Yeah. It puts you on his level. Like, you're
right, him. Right. That's a good way to put it.
And what also really works in this movie is that the director, and that's something we didn't have in the 50s and before, is that we talked about there's good and evil. And in this one, like, he is a bad guy, like, he kills people, and usually for the most part he kills, like, lower people, like
prostitutes
and yeah. And but we also see that he didn't just, like, he isn't just evil because he's evil, like it was usually the case. No, he was, like, kind of, by his father, he was, like, in psychological tests, experiments by his father about, like, how to kill people and things. So it's,
yeah,
it's really on a whole nother level once more, where they're like, suddenly you almost feel sorry for him in parts.
And it threw the audience into a place they weren't ready to be yet.
Yeah.
They weren't ready to explore those ideas and feel safe at the same time. And so a great way to distance yourself from that would be to say, well, this is trash. Like, I can't relate to that at all. This is fucking garbage. But it's really not. And it sucks that, and it might have been in your book, and I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I read, like, Michael Powell didn't really do anything after.
Yeah, I think so as well. Like, he was basically done after this.
I'll look it up real quick if you have anything to add from the book.
Yeah, I'm sure. I have a lot here. Like, this is the next British horror film after Curse of Frankenstein and Horror of Dracula that also uses violence, ugliness, and blood. And it caused hysteria, basically, that the British horror film is all just about that anymore. Like, there's no deeper stories anymore. It's all violence, ugliness, and blood.
Right.
And the killer is basically, yeah, like I said, a normal guy with a problem, and is tortured by his heritage, where just like a few years prior we had a talk of Bad Seed, where, like, how do you become, is it your environment or can you inherit it? And he, maybe it's both, but it's mostly about his environment. Like, he was this one made is, this
yeah.
way.
Yeah. And it looks like Michael Powell had a huge career from 1930 up until 68 or 60. And then he did a couple movies and some TV, but that was it.
Yeah. So this was like basically the end.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a ton of stuff from 30 all the way up till 60. There's got to be at least like 30 credits right here, 40 credits. So, yeah, because he's got 60 total credits with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 being after Peeping Tom, and 3 were television and 1 was a documentary.
Okay, so yeah, it went downhill for him.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting, that isn't even said in the book, but I think I said that before when we talked about this movie, but the lead actor, he's credited, he's as Karl Böhm, but his real name is Karl-Heinz Böhm. He's a German actor, and he's over here is mostly known for his role as, like, there's this genre, the Heimatfilm, which is like the... It's just like lovely scenes of rich people having problems in living in their mansions.
And oh, yeah, you told me about that.
Yeah, he's so there's these stories of Sissy, which is like a name people in Germany recognize. It's like this princess, I think, of Austria, and he plays her love interest. That's what he's known for here over here mostly. And it was like in the early 50s, I think.
55,
yeah. He was like the good guy. He was the love interest. And in this one, he goes to England and is a crazy serial killer and psychopath.
Right. And is this one of the, I mean, one of the first where you have we had some stuff before that, but where you have a really, like, good-looking, charismatic killer, you know? Because he's, even in this movie, like, he gets along with people. He's able to talk to people. He's not the recluse that you normally see, you know, hiding away in the shadows, or what you think of as a kind of traditional killer.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of like Night of the Hunter. Like, he was very charismatic and got along with everybody, even though he's a fucking monster.
Yeah. Even like in Eyes Without a Face, like the doctor.
The doctor. Yeah.
Yeah. He is socially accepted. He's like a big person there. But yeah, this is kind of different because he's like going really out and killing prostitutes with the camera and filming it. Like, it's a whole nother level of psychotic and evil.
Yeah. Makes you think of like American Psycho, you know, Christian Bale, such a good looking guy, but he's just a fucking monster underneath.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, this movie is just so good. And I think most of these we're talking about right now, I got on DVD or Blu-ray, and like, I feel like watching this one again pretty soon.
Yeah, but, and it sucks that it, you know, wasn't. But a lot of these movies were not well received when they first came out. It takes time for it to sit. And I feel like that's the problem we have with movies today, at least a lot of the big ones, you know, your theater movies that people are going out to see, is it's almost formulaic. I was talking to Will the other day, who's been on the show a couple times, and I had sent him an article I was reading that Warner Brothers is going to start using artificial intelligence to figure out which movies will produce the biggest return on investment. And I'm like, man, that's fucked up. Like, that's not where we need to be. Whereas with Peeping Tom and a lot of this stuff, people, at least I think, I don't know, but we're making movies and telling the stories they wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And now we don't have that quite as much. And a lot of those, these are the stories I want to tell. You think even Night of the Living Dead, you go back and even Friday the 13th, even though they were trying to copy, like Sean Cunningham and those guys were trying to copy Halloween, were trying to copy the formula, they were so poorly received. I want to say Friday the 13th, the original got 0 out of 5 stars.
Yeah, it's usually... It's very hated, yeah, the Friday the 13th, even though so it changed Peeping, history.
And that's the same with Peeping Tom. I don't feel we would have horror the same way we have it today without Peeping Tom coming out. But it takes 10, 15 years before people are able to look at it in hindsight and say, you know what, that was important. That was an important thing that they did.
Although I think what happened here more than like with... We got to say with Friday the 13th, that's really not as good a movie. It's a fun horror movie, but it's not as good a movie.
Oh, yeah. You know, the more I think about Friday, I watched the big Crystal Lake Memories.
Yeah.
So almost 7 hours of documentary about the series. And I wouldn't even put the original in my top three, I don't think, as far as the way I enjoy them. None of those movies are really... like stand-up movies.
Yeah.
You know, they were more fun roller coaster rides. And you cheer for Jason. You're like, yeah, let's see it. What's he going to do next? Jason's fucking crazy.
And with Peeping Tom, it's like, it's a really good movie. It was just, I feel like, too uncomfortable for the people at the time.
I would
because
agree.
Because it was something that was so different that even like, if you could regard that it had good camera work, that it had good acting, that it was well done... You were still so disgusted. It's kind of like maybe almost like when we watch now a Serbian film that is really well made.
Right.
But it's really just so fucked up that you don't want to watch it and that you give it a low rating. Even though for the most part, if you take the story out, it's a pretty well made movie. It's
a very well made movie.
Yeah.
And Peeping Tom forced individuals to look not only at themselves, but at the world around them. And realize that anyone could be a monster.
Yeah.
You know, it's not Frankenstein's monster. It's not Dracula. There's horror in the real world. And I think people didn't want to, they didn't want to face that. They didn't want to have to look at that.
And even worse, like with the mirrors that he puts into the face of the victims he kills to see their fear. He also kind of, the director also kind of puts a mirror to the audience saying like,
why are you here watching?
Yeah, why are you watching this? And I think that's also something that people don't particularly like to be called out. It's almost like with Black Christmas, where we are called out to be men in the new world.
Right. Oh, yeah, it was so bad. Or, you know, more modern, I think, of Funny Games really calls out the audience. Like, why are you here? If you don't want to see true real world horror for what it is, then what are you doing here to begin with?
Yeah, and... That movie got also there's lots of people who hate that movie because of that,
right?
So yeah. We don't like being called out. It's just the truth.
Yeah.
So and also I'm gonna call us out for going way over time because we still have like 3 more movies to go.
Yeah,
and these are
well, one of them we won't have to talk a lot about. And you know, the next one though, I want to spend a few minutes with, and that is 1960s Black Sunday.
For me, in the book, the next one is Psycho, actually.
Oh, okay. Are they flip-flopped?
Yeah,
I Black guess Sunday. So. Okay. Well, we can do Psycho then.
Yeah, let's go with Psycho really quick because
we have talked this movie to death. Everyone listening knows it's one of my... I mean, it fights to be my favorite movie of all time. It is in my top three. And some of the... I've given all my reasons so many times. We've talked about our favorite moments in the movie. It is just, for me... a masterclass in movie making. It really is. Like even that opening sequence with the bars, you know, that go back and forth, the white and the black, that dun 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 dun. And but where this movie works so well and why Hitchcock kept people out of the theaters, and this is one of the few instances where I will say I like the movie more than the book. Norman Bates was a very different character in the book. He was kind of overweight and balding, kind of a greasier character. Somebody who you might think could have something wrong with them. Whereas Anthony Perkins' depiction of Norman Bates, he's such a lovable guy and somebody you feel so bad for by the time you get to the end of the movie. But never before had we had a main character killed off, you know, 45 minutes into the movie. That just wasn't a thing.
It's still a thing these days.
Yeah, I've read in the past that movie theater, like the audiences wouldn't even believe it that it had happened. Because she was such a big name at the time. You know, Janet Leigh was someone that everyone knew. You knew who she was.
She was the sell for this movie. That's what people went to see.
It wouldn't have been this movie without her. And even the little tiny nuanced stuff of her, you know, wearing the white undergarments when she's still innocent. And then when she gets to the hotel after she's committed this act of stealing all this money, she's now in all the black. All the little things that make Psycho, Psycho. The score, just it's in my eyes, it is a perfect movie. There's nothing I would change about Psycho that I think would add or take away from it.
It really is. And I just want to go through a few points that the book makes really quick.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, the first quote I can take from the book is, "No one watches Psycho for the first time." And that's kind of true these days because it has been done to death. Like, everyone knows Psycho. Even if you haven't seen the movie, you know it.
Or you know the shower music. You know, rah, rah, rah.
Exactly. And I think that's a great quote that totally works. And also what the book says, what I really like, and thinking about it, it makes me even more appreciate it, I think, is that when you talked to Hitchcock about the movie or his movies in general and asked him about like deeper meaning in the movies, he would always take it to technical aspects because his point was always to get a reaction out of the audience, and like deeper meaning was always just a byproduct of it. Like, he just wanted to entertain, really. And like there is so much more to it, but his main point was always entertaining people, and I really like that. And actually what this book says, what I think is really interesting and might be controversial, is that the book compares Psycho to Peeping Tom and says that Peeping Tom shows a killer in pain and puts melodrama in there, while Hitchcock just goes for the story, and that might make Peeping Tom the more likable movie.
Never.
So
false.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, Peeping Tom, I really like Peeping Tom, but
yeah, it's a great movie.
Psycho is so much better.
it in my eyes, it'll always be the superior compared to a lot of movies. It'll always, because Psycho for me, no matter how many times I've seen this movie, and it is a lot, I have seen this movie a lot, it never loses its punch. And unlike Peeping Tom, which I think had some good performances, when Janet Leigh and Anthony Perkins are eating together in the study, that is fucking unbelievable. Like, just the camera shots, their exchanges with one another, where she's like, you know, well, why don't you just leave? Well, I couldn't leave my mother here. Who would ever? Well, a boy's best friend is his mother. You know, one of the most famous lines from the movie. And like you said, nobody ever sees Psycho for the first time anymore. But that ending is one of the best endings ever put into a movie. No one saw that shit coming. You did not imagine that it was him dressed up talking as his mother, even when he's carrying her. You know, you get that good bird's eye view over the stairs, the same one when Arbogast gets knocked down, of Norman carrying his mom down to the cellar. You know, you've got to go hide. You've got to go do this. That payoff is so good. So good.
It really is. Let's move on because we're
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So next up, as I had mentioned earlier, was 1960s Black Sunday.
Yeah.
And Black Sunday for me, what it's always been, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, because we had the real early stuff like Haxan that we had talked about when we first started doing this list. But I feel like Black Sunday was really the foundation for all of these Satanic Panic movies. Like, yeah. I don't know if we would have The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby without Black Sunday. Did I say Black Christmas?
But, you might have, yeah, I'm not sure.
I may have. But you wouldn't have those movies without Black Sunday. But then you also have some really haunting imagery in Black Sunday. Like the mask with the spikes and stuff on it. Like that's awful. Like that is awful.
Yeah, that's like a great torture device though.
Yeah. It's almost like an Iron Maiden in a way. Yeah, where they stick this thing on her face. Ugh.
The German title of this movie, so the Italian title of this movie is of course La Maschera del Demonio, which I guess means The Mask of the Demon. The German title of this movie is Die Stunde, wenn Dracula kommt. So, The Hour When Dracula Comes, which makes no sense at all.
Right?
So, I'm always having a problem remembering what movie this is because the title just has no connection to the movie, really.
And we have to, you know, say one of the greatest horror directors of all time. This is his handiwork.
And this is his first movie.
Is it his first? I didn't know it was his first.
Yeah, he co-directed, like he finished two movies of, what's his name? Riccardo Freda.
Oh,
he finished those movies, but this was the first movie Mario Bava made on his own.
And for some reason, I thought he was all the way back into like the 50s. For some reason, I thought he was like 56, 57.
I think in that time, he was a cameraman and like working with people. But like this was his first movie he directed by himself.
Oh, nice.
And also, this is only the third Italian horror movie of all time. That's
really?
What the book says, yeah. And the other two were the ones he co-directed. So he's basically the father of Italian horror.
Yeah, and most people would give him the credit for being that.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the name Bava and even his kid, you know, he's got good pedigree. So, man, that's cool to know. So Black Sunday, though, is the story of a witch.
Yeah.
And it's a witch who is, you know, tortured and killed after, and then like a lot of these movies that would become a staple of witch movies later on, you know, swear revenge and or put a curse on a village or something like that leading up to the death. And she gets, what is it? She gets released from her tomb later on and then is going to take over the body of one of her descendants. I'm pretty sure it's one of her descendants. Yeah.
Yeah, I think her great granddaughter or something.
Yeah, and then enact her revenge. So it's her and kind of this servant character, and then we carry on. But again, the biggest thing I think and why it's on this list, not only that it's Bava's first movie, I didn't know that, because he is, like you said, credited as being the father of Italian horror. So would we have all our Argentos and our Falcis and all these guys without Bava? Who knows? I'm sure we would, but for him to show, you know, okay, we can do this too. Like, we can do it and we can do it a little bit differently because, like I said, a lot of the imagery in this movie is really scary.
Yeah, the book actually compares this movie to the Hammer horror movies and says, like, there's, even though it's, like, kind of the same time and kind of, like, the same plot, like gothic horror, but it's done completely differently and it lists some differences. As in, like, while the Hammer horror movies are all in color and technicolor and really bright, this one shines with, like, its black and white cinematography and, like, almost closer to a German expressionism. Also, while Hammer horror, the book here says that it's, like, childish sexuality in kind of a way where, like, you know, lots of cleavage. The Bava movie Black Sunday goes a lot more for the erotic death. Like it's something completely different, where it's still kind of erotic, but in a whole different way than the classic movies, the Hammer horror movies. And lastly,
yeah, I can see that.
And lastly, it says that none of the cleavage showing, I think, Daughters of Death of the Hammer horror movies, all these women, you know, in the movie, none of them come close to Barbara Steele in her,
right?
Where she's like, actually, like, she is the lead of this movie and she is what sells this movie. Barbara Steele is the, like, one of the first scream queens basically. And like, who was in like all these horror movies at the time.
And she did such a good job.
Yeah.
Such a good job.
Yeah. And, I thought that was really interesting. And yet, like we know in most Italian horror movies, this movie is also not as much about the story itself. It's more about, in this case, not the gore, but the cinematography and like the black and white shooting and not as much about the story, which we see in, like, I think there's basically no Italian horror movies about story. The story is always second for Italians.
It's right. It's always about, give me that good stuff. Give me that, give me that gore and scares. And yeah, but it works. It still works so well, I think, because you're right. She is fantastic in it. The story is not as deep, but I think it showed a lot of filmmakers, okay, we can explore these topics in a modern time, especially in a culture that, you know, this was kind of pre-counterculture. And so you had everything that was very Leave It to Beaver and stuff like that. So too, and you had I don't know if you had more people going to church or not, but to explore this ideas of witchcraft and evil that could be real, you know, kind of religious evil in a way. And to be able to explore that was cool.
Yeah, it's really a great movie. I got to rewatch it though, because I have only watched it once. And with Italian horror movies, I feel like you need to watch them at least twice to really appreciate them. Yeah.
Well, even when we did the Fulci episode, you were like, I don't know what's what. They just all blend together, because they really do in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I had seen all the movies and rewatched them all. And for the most part, it felt like watching them all for the first time. It's crazy.
Right.
Also, what I find interesting, there's a quote of Bava in this book. Saying in a horror film, the photography is 70% of the. This is where it's hard to translate on the fly.
Yeah.
Like it's 70% is the photography, the whole atmosphere.
Right. So, the experience of it, to be able to draw you in and make you believe that it's a real place, that it's a real intangible place. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, the sets were great in that movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful movie. Yeah. Like, it is so much fun. Absolutely love it. All right. We've got one more left on the list.
Yeah. And this is one we talked about before, I think, as well, because, like, this is one that
you had told me to watch for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
For months, you were telling me, got to watch this. And then when I finally did, I was like, man, I'm so mad I didn't watch this immediately when Josh told me to watch this. Yeah. And that is 1961's The Innocents. And I got a question about this. Have you seen the trailer for that new movie coming out with Finn Wolfhard?
That's where they go to the... is it with Finn Wolfhard? I've seen the trailer yesterday for The Lodge, where they're in the... That's probably not the one you're talking about.
No, I don't know if it was The Lodge. It was The Turning. Have you seen the trailer for The Turning?
I don't think so, no.
I want to say, man, this might be a remake of The Innocents, but I don't know.
Well, you know, the Innocence is based on a book titled The Turning of the Screw.
Yeah. So, you're right. It says it right here in the IMDb. Yeah. So it's a modern take on Henry James' novella, The Turn of the Screw. Because I watched the trailer and I was like, is this the same movie? You got this woman who has to go to this big mansion, take care of this niece and nephew. So I'll be watching that just based solely on, and that comes out in a couple weeks. That's soon. So I want to see this. It comes out on the 20th. At least over here, it comes out on the 24th of January.
Got to check when it comes out here. Yeah.
The Innocents, you had told me, you got to watch this movie. It stars Deborah Kerr. She does an amazing job in this thing. What I enjoyed, I think, more than anything about this movie is you never really get, I feel like I never really got the answers that I was looking for, but I was okay with it.
Yeah.
It's very ambiguous by the time you get to the end. And where this movie shines, kind of like the last one, is the setting is so good. You feel so isolated in this world of madness. Yeah. You almost feel trapped with her in this space.
Yeah, because she is kind of isolated, right? It's a house a bit outside, and she's there with like these two little kids who are kind of weird. Like this goes back to the bad seed, where like the kids feel kind of
off.
Yeah, off. That's a good word to say, yeah. And the book here always also says that it's interesting how Kerr's character is very religious and like innocent, basically, while the kids seem almost more experienced with their own sexuality. Like when she has, like, it's almost like almost too much what we get in this movie, where like she has like this kiss with the little boy, with Miles, where it's almost that you can feel sexual tension between them, and that's not
so weird.
Yeah,
yeah.
And Yeah, but this movie is just so great and just creepy from the opening. This is an mm-hmm. opening I will never forget, when there's just like the little boys singing under the weeping willow, right. Like just like no sounds other than that, and just we see this tree and there's just a kid singing. It's always creepy.
It is so atmospheric. And the story, for anyone interested, you have a woman who is tasked with going to oversee, is it her niece and nephew?
No, it's, I think, two orphaned children.
Like, oh, that's right, yeah.
She's just hired to get there. So
were they orphaned, or was their dad just gone a lot?
The book says they're orphaned. I'm okay, not fully
so
sure.
So maybe they were orphaned. But yeah. Anyway, she goes way out into the countryside, middle of nowhere, to this huge mansion of a home. It almost feels like a castle. And her job is now to oversee these two kids. And as the movie progresses, weirder and weirder shit starts happening. And you don't know if it's ghosts, if it's an evil entity, or if it's these kids or monsters.
Yeah, actually, I didn't get one part from the movie that is in the book and that is set, that some people got that, is that it might also be just her going crazy. And I feel the movie never kind of made it seem like she was going crazy. It felt like there was something off, but she felt sane, basically.
Yeah,
at least to me. I never got the feeling that she was going crazy, which I think is a big part of the book, where it's all about, is she crazy or is something going on?
Maybe I need to read this book. I'll have to see if I can find it, The Turn of the Screw. Because, yeah, maybe there's more in there, because I never took away that she was going nuts.
Yeah, me neither.
It always felt external, like there was something outside of her power.
Yeah, exactly.
Tormenting her.
Yeah. And since we're talking about also the book, my good friend and regular on the show by now, Maike, she, not too long ago, like we were talking about horror in general, and she told me about this book she was reading that she heard was really good. And then she started telling me the story of like this lady going to the to these two children to look out for them, and then she's kind of going crazy. And I was like, wait, this sounds too familiar. And yeah, she was reading Turn of the Screw, and she said she didn't like it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, what she said was that it was just, it's lots of, like, it's written, of course, like, this is an older book, so it's written in this kind of different language, you know, in this different kind of English.
Different kind of prose.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think it's first person, all written by the
governess.
The governess, exactly.
Yeah.
And Maike said there's just lots of scenes of her just like saying how great these children are and how sweet these children are. And like it would go on and on telling how great these are. So yeah, but it is a highly regarded book, so maybe Maike just doesn't appreciate the art.
Maike, what are you thinking? I have to see if I can get my hands on it. I'm sure it's out there somewhere. I can get a copy of it to
probably
read it, because
yeah.
And I do enjoy that kind of old English language. I mean, really, it was everything post Hemingway. Hemingway's the one who a lot of people credit for destroying the English language and making it much more, I don't know, ground level. It wasn't so much a high art as it was just ground level writing, which I love Hemingway on the same token. So you take from it what you will. So The Innocents, though, very good. Very good. And I think it's on YouTube. I think I watched it on YouTube.
It might be. I got the Blu-ray. Like, I'm going to watch it in the best quality possible. And
I want to say I might have bought it as well, because I think it was on iTunes, but I'm not sure. I can look that up later. Yeah. So that is our number 21 through 30. I'm going to go through really quick and read 31 through 40, just in case anyone is following along. And so we've got Carnival of Souls, which...
Can't wait to talk about that one.
I know. I love that movie. All of these. Like, all these, I'm just looking right in a row. Carnival of Souls, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking Betty Davis and Joan Crawford are just unbelievably good in that.
Yeah, that movie is fucked up.
After that, you've got The Haunting from 1963, followed up by The Birds. And then Onibaba. I've never seen Onibaba.
I've seen Onibaba. I got the DVD. It's Japanese. It's different, but it's I like it a lot.
I'm excited to see that one. The Mask of the Red Death. We've got Vincent Price coming back, and that might have been some of the Roger Corman stuff. I'm not sure, but I think that was Roger Corman.
It is Roger Corman, yeah.
Oh, okay. Perfect. After that is Repulsion, which is fucking awesome. I think we talked about it. Didn't we talk about Repulsion?
Yeah, that was one that I had, like, that you made me watch, basically.
Yeah.
That we talked about a lot, and you said I got... I think that was on the other list that we did a year back or so.
And Repulsion, I think, is Polanski.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then next after that is it Vi or Spirit of Evil?
Yeah.
Which I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, this seems to be like Czech or something. Like, so it's right. Something completely different.
Hopefully we can find that one. And then you've got Hour of the Wolf, which I watched just earlier this year. And did you watch it as well?
Yeah, I watched it as
well.
Yeah,
we talked about it.
Yeah, I think so.
And lastly is The Devil Rides Out, which is another great one.
Okay, so for me in the book, actually, in the book, it's the other way around. The last one is Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, so those are flipped on this list as well. So,
yeah.
Okay, well, we'll go with Rosemary's Baby then. And I guess the other one will have to come after that.
Yeah, but that's pretty good because... I need to see where I can find The Devil Rides Out. I think that's one that's not released over here at all.
Yeah, I want to say it was streaming over here for a while. I think I might have a copy of it, like a DVD copy somewhere.
I just have to move to the US.
You do. You just got to do it, man. You just got to do it. Just make it happen, please. So that's it. That is it. We've done it. We've done another 10. We'll probably, it'll be a little while before we... do it again because it is a big undertaking to make sure that you've seen them all and watched them all and have some kind of good understanding of all of those.
And
The Devil Rides Out, Christopher Lee, man. Christopher Lee.
Gotta
get my hands
on
that.
Yeah, he is a staple. But yeah, we're now at 1 hour and 40 minutes already.
So we've been doing it for a little bit. But that's okay. That's why we come here to do the show, because we like to do it and we have fun. So if you want to get into contact with us, it's at IHOH Podcast on all the social media platforms, or you can email us IHOHpodcast@gmail.com. And if you'd be so kind to jump onto Apple Podcasts, leave a rate and review, it would be greatly appreciated. We like those rates and reviews.
Yes.
So for the International House of Horrors, I've been Joe Merle.
I've been Josh.
And we'll be back next week with more things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre.